Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we begin a periodic series on peace building. In the midst of a contentious presidential election year, many of us are really feeling the need for increased peace in the world, the nation, our neighborhoods, families, and in our own hearts. That's to say nothing of the wars and conflicts raging right now in the world. We'll be talking today with Patrick Mason and David Pulsifer, authors of the book Proclaim Peace, The Restoration's Answer to an Age of Conflict. Patrick Mason is Leonard J. Arrington Chair of Mormon History and Culture at Utah State University, Associate Professor of Religious Studies and History. David Pulsifer is Professor of History at Brigham Young University, Idaho. We'll be talking with them following the news. Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we'll begin a periodic series on peace building. In the midst of a contentious presidential election year, many of us are really feeling the need for increased peace in the world, the nation, our neighborhood, families, in our hearts. Let's say nothing of the wars and conflicts raging now all over the world. And we'll be talking with Patrick Mason and David Pulsifer, authors of Proclaim Peace, The Restoration's Answer to an Age of Conflict. Patrick Mason is Leonard J. Arrington Chair of Mormon History and Culture and an Associate Professor of Religious Studies and History at Utah State University. He's on the Faculty Advisory Board of the Harabi Peace Institute at Utah State University. Patrick Mason, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Tom. Great to be with you.
Thanks. We appreciate having you on with us again. David Pulsifer is Professor of History at Brigham Young University, Idaho, where he teaches courses on citizenship, civil discourse, peace building, and nonviolence. David Pulsifer, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. So Patrick Mason, I'll ask the same question of David Pulsifer. First to you, Patrick. How do you come to this subject? I think you've been involved with this for quite some time.
I have, and it's a little bit inexplicable, actually. I mean, I was raised in the suburbs of Salt Lake City and Sandy, particularly. I had a very comfortable growing up. I was not the victim of violence. I was not, you know, a party to any kind of major or serious conflict. But it's actually my early years at Brigham Young University, where I was an undergraduate. I took a course on the history of civilization that focused on the idea that humans are always in the quest for peace and in the pursuit of peace, but we always end up fighting each other, and we always end up in war and committing atrocities against one another. And so we studied that theme throughout the history of the world, and that really sparked something in me in terms of a deep desire to try to better understand these conflicts and this violence that is endemic throughout the world in every culture, in every period in human history. And so when I went to graduate school, I didn't know there was such a thing called peace studies, but I sort of stumbled into it at the University of Notre Dame, specifically the Joan Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies. And so I ended up getting a master's degree in international peace studies. And in a lot of ways, that just absolutely transformed the way that I think, not just as an academic, but the way that I see the world. I learned new concepts. I learned new tools. I met incredible people from all around the world, people from different cultures and countries and religions who had dedicated their lives to peace building in different ways. From South Africa to Israel, Palestine, to Iran, to Latin America and Burma, Myanmar. I mean, just incredible people all around the world. And so my path has been as an academic, but this interest in violence and in peace building and in trying to make the world a more just place has been, you know, part of what I've tried to do throughout my career.
David Pulsifer, same question to you. How did you get into this?
Well, in many ways, it was kind of a similar, although a little different, journey than Patrick's. I also grew up in a very peaceful home and a peaceful community in the corner of the Salt Lake Valley. Went to BYU. Didn't have my transformative experience at BYU. I had it in graduate school. Went to the University of Minnesota, and my degree is actually in my doctorate is in American Studies. As part of American Studies, we really kind of did a deep dive into, struggle and power and the way language and culture can be used in that in those efforts and a lot of study of how those kinds of things can lead to the oppression of one group by another group. I found it all extraordinarily helpful and enlightening, but I also found it, I just began wondering, well, these theories help explain a lot of the way I see the world, but what also explains selflessness and altruism and love? And I began asking my professors there, and none of them had a good answer for me, but they all thought it was a great question. They all brought it up in my dissertation defense and said, David, what did you find out about that? Those great questions you were asking. And I had to say, well, nothing. I don't really have any answers. Nobody could point me in the right direction. I wasn't fortunate enough to be at a place like Notre Dame that had a peace studies program. So there was no place for them to point me at the University of Minnesota. But all wonderful faculty that were really interested in the questions. It wasn't until I started teaching at what was then Ricks College back in 1997 and started teaching American history courses and specifically the civil rights movement, and started hearing, as I'm showing video clips to my students and studying, the history of the movement, I was fascinated particularly by a phrase that Martin Luther King used called, when he talked about using the weapon of love, and I was kind of hooked pretty quick on what was happening there. In particular, I began to read all sorts of nonviolence theory, began teaching classes on it, and just kind of read my way into that particular angle of peace studies, nonviolent action, and fascinated in particular with the way it transformed my thinking about my own faith and as a Latter-day Saint. Began reading my scriptures differently. I began to see things that I hadn't seen before. And that's really where kind of my focus has been on kind of that intersection of nonviolence theory in particular. And then meeting Patrick, he helped open up a whole other area of peace studies that I was unfamiliar with, because of his training. And, it's been a great journey and frankly, a wonderful partnership with Patrick over the years as we've kind of explored how that plays out, in particular within our faith community. So,
great. I'll direct this next question to both of you, starting with Patrick. I'm going to fast forward to, maybe we would, under normal circumstances, treat this later in the hour, but where I come to from this, and I feel a little, lot privileged. Here in the U.S., lately we haven't gone through, what they did in Rwanda, et cetera. We're not living through Ukraine right now, et cetera, et cetera. But I think we do feel, I certainly feel, the lack of peace in my personal life, especially in the arena of politics. Can't have Uncle So-and-so over for dinner. You have to be very careful at church talking about certain things, right? You have to walk on eggshells around your neighbors. And it doesn't seem like it's getting better. So I guess my specific question to you, Patrick, is, as you've studied this, do you have hope that following the principles we're going to talk about this hour can make a difference? I guess it can make a difference in your own life.
Yeah, it's a great question, Tom. And you're right. And, those of us who live in the United States, the United States has been blessed with just an incredible stretch of domestic peace and security and tranquility. Obviously, we've been involved in a number of foreign wars, but it's actually that hasn't really touched most people's lives here within the country. So it's really been just in the last few years that I think a lot of people feel the same way you do. I certainly do. It's pretty rare to find somebody who hasn't experienced that kind of increase in conflict and the difficult conversations and relationships that are frayed, maybe even broken, around politics and social issues and all these things. We see it on college campuses. I mean, it just seems everywhere. And there are a lot of really bad indicators. I mean, we just have to be honest. I mean, if you look at what a lot of social scientists are saying, what a lot of political scientists are saying, that some of the things that are happening in our country right now are indicative of things that have happened in other countries on the path to overt violence. Of course, we got a taste of that with January 6th. A few years ago, but to see something that would really break out into more widespread, and overt conflict, there is a path towards that, that is a very real possibility. And I think we have to be honest about that. But I love the word that you use, Tom, whether I have hope, and the answer to that is yes. I think hope is one of the great tools in the peace builder's toolkit. And it's not a kind of flimsy wish. It's not a naivete. Actually, I think peace builders, to be effective, they have to be very clear-eyed about the situations that we find ourselves in. We can't be Pollyannish. We can't just have our head in the clouds. We have to know exactly what's going on. We have to know where the conflicts are. We have to know the tensions that are around us and the potential for escalation. But there has to be hope as well. And it's precisely because peace and peace building principles and tools have worked and do work all around the world, that it gives me a great deal of confidence that if they are pursued both at the individual level, at the social level, at the political level, that actually we can de-escalate conflict. We can do it in our marriages. We can do it in our communities and our churches, but we could do it at the political level as well. That takes decided effort. It takes committed effort. It takes people of skill and commitment to do it. But it is possible. So it's not inevitable that we're just on this path to getting worse and worse. We can make choices to kind of bring things back and to build a more healthy, peaceful society.
Patrick, I want to follow up with you. I know you were just in Rwanda. Tell me, but is that an example now? You had horrible violence in Rwanda, a few years back. Are there peace building efforts going on there?
Yeah, well, I could spend the whole hour talking just about that, so I'll try to be brief. I was there as part of a study abroad trip that Utah State University took, and I have to give a huge credit to my colleague, Dr. Shannon Peterson in political science, who led the trip, as well as an organization called Youth Link from Salt Lake City, run by Justin Powell. They were really the ones who organized and led the trip, and it was incredible. And for people who don't remember or don't know about it, very briefly, 30 years ago in 1994, the country of Rwanda in Africa experienced the worst genocide since the Holocaust, since World War II, in the space of only 100 days. From April to July of that year, 1 million people were killed. It's just astonishing. And so we went and we visited many of the genocide sites and memorials, and it was completely overwhelming. I mean, I don't have words to express the depth and the scope and just the depravity of the type of killing that was done. It is truly horrific. It's the worst thing I've ever seen, in terms of what human beings can do to one another. But the story didn't just end in 1994. The great part of this trip, what I loved about it, was not just dwelling on what happened 30 years ago, but we really focused on what has happened in the 30 years since. And Rwanda is one of the great laboratories for forgiveness and reconciliation all around the world. It is amazing. It's not perfect. Of course, there have been road bumps. There are, obstacles. But we met with people all around the country, people who were survivors, whose entire families had been killed in the genocide, people who were former perpetrators, people who themselves had killed other people. And there has been a concerted effort towards reconciliation in the country that is really working. And if you talk to especially younger Rwandans, they say, I'm not Hutu or I'm not Tutsi, these sort of ethnic identities that fueled the conflict 30 years ago. They say, I'm Rwandan. So they've made a concerted effort towards a unified identity. They have supported efforts to, around forgiveness and reconciliation, materially as well as kind of emotionally and politically. And so while Rwanda is in many ways the, you know, it's exhibit A for what we do not want to do in our societies in terms of what happened in 1994, I think it's also exhibit A for what, how you can pull out of that and how individuals and a society at large can decide, no, we will pursue the path of forgiveness and reconciliation. It's really hard. It does not change what happened in the past. It doesn't change our differences. There are still ongoing animosities, but we can build structures, and also in our own hearts, we can do things to promote forgiveness. It really was remarkable to see. I was truly inspired by what I saw the Rwandans doing to promote forgiveness. I think we could learn a lot of lessons from them in our country.
David Pulsifer, I wonder if you, same question to you. Do you have hope from your personal experiences? And I guess building off of what Patrick said, that violence, conflict is not inevitable. What examples, maybe can you give us a couple of examples of peace building you participated in or seen that are especially hopeful to you?
Well, I'm with Patrick in that I have hope. You cannot be involved in this process without that hope, and it really is. I mean, even with all of the challenges that we have been facing as a country politically and within our families, I have seen remarkable examples, just really small ones, nothing nearly on the scale of what Patrick was getting a chance to witness over there in Rwanda. I really have hope we're not going to get to that level of violence and then have to engage in that level of reconciliation and forgiveness. But there's lots of examples of that happening in small ways and in families. Over the last several years, my interest in peace building has led me into learning the skills of mediation. And so one of the things that I've been involved in for 5 years now has been just helping small-scale mediation, small claims courts, family disputes, neighborhood issues. And it's in that process that I have really come to believing more deeply that it is possible for us to get past the divides that are happening within our communities and our families. And that there are very simple, difficult, but simple things that we can be doing that will help us to reconcile, to move forward, to be able to transform our conflicts from things that are really destructive into things that are much more creative and hopeful and helpful. I've seen it there are just magical moments that happen in the midst of some of the mediations I've been involved in that have been wonderful to see people that come into a room deeply divided, angry, even hateful towards one another. And by the end of the session, we've got people who have figured out how to move forward with their particular conflict, have found a solution, and even in some cases just reconciled with one another. And it's brought me to tears at several points as I've watched that happen. I think that can happen at a small scale, as I've seen, but also we can get it can happen at a large scale. There are really just some very basic principles that if we would learn how to adopt them, we could live with one another, and we could not just tolerate one another, but actually appreciate the differences that we have and be able to use those in much more creative ways than we're doing currently.
I want to follow up just very briefly. What are some of those basic principles that you've found so effective?
Well, one of the things that we do in mediation, and which is, I think, at the heart of all peace building, is creating spaces in which people can see one another as human beings, as people, seeing people as people, not seeing them as in kind of an objective or objectifying way. And so what we do in mediation is try to create these spaces where people can turn towards one another, see one another, recognize in the other person hopes and dreams and fears, anxieties that are every bit as real as their own hopes and dreams and fears and anxieties. It's really in that just very simple space of being able to kind of step away from the conflict for a second. Because when we're in the midst of a conflict, all we want to do is see the other side as kind of monsters. I mean, you hear that kind of language happening all the time, this kind of dehumanizing of the other side. And we even do it in our families, right? Where we, I just can't talk to that person. They just, you know, they're just, I can't believe that they do these things or believe in this way of believing or support this particular candidate that I just can't support, or this political party or whatever it might be. And soon they become this kind of these objects that are standing in the way of what we think is our society, you know, our society, our community. They're threats, they're dangers to us. They're no longer human beings. Being able to be able to make the hard choice to not do that and just to be able to see them as truly as human, as real people. That very simple principle. And it's hard to get to that space. But if we can create those spaces where we can do that, and then peace really is possible. We really can learn to live and work with our differences rather than dividing us and ultimately leading to all sorts of horrible forms of violence.
Before we go to break, Patrick, do you want to comment on anything there, that those principles that we can apply in our personal life?
Yeah, well, I was just having a conversation recently with a woman who practices exactly what David talks about in her own life, and she had remarkable stories. And I've done some of this, but I really like the way that she framed it. She said she sort of just recognized that there were people around her in her neighborhood, in her church congregation, that she just really didn't know. She knew that they believed different things than her. She knew that they had different political signs in their yard than she did, and so forth. And she was polite to them, and they said hi to each other, you know, passing in the hallway or something like that. But she says, I really don't know them as people. And so she has made the habit of, she will go out of her way to call somebody and say, hey, can we go to lunch? And it seems that we probably disagree about some things. I see you've got this yard sign, or I've heard you make this comment. We probably see the world in kind of different ways. I'm really curious about that. Can we go and you can just tell me about it so I can learn more about the way you see the world? She doesn't go into it with wanting to debate the person or wanting to correct the person or even to share her own views. She goes in specifically with curiosity and with an attitude of listening to really try to understand that person. And as she's done that, as I've done that in my life, I realized that very few people, I don't know that I've ever met a person. I admit that there probably are some, but I don't think I've ever met a single person who wakes up in the morning and says, I want to be evil today. I want to do evil in the world. People go about their lives that they have political opinions. They orient themselves at work or in different ways because of the way that they see the world, because of problems that they see that they want to solve in a particular way, because of experiences that they've had that have shaped who they are. And so I think exactly what David says, the more that we can really make a proactive and intentional practice of seeing people as people, coming to it with curiosity, trying to understand them, not convert them. That's going to be the first step. That doesn't solve everything by any means, but it actually, I think, goes a long way. I think one of the big problems we have in our country today is we can't even see or hear each other. We are in our echo chambers and we have all kinds of narratives about the other side, but how much are we actually listening to the other side? So I completely agree with David. That's a great first step.
Let's take a brief break. We'll be back with much more in this conversation. We're talking with the authors of the book Proclaim Peace, The Restoration's Answer to an Age of Conflict. Well worth the read. Came out in 2021. It's still available, and and on your usual outlets, and well worth the read. We're going to be talking a little bit more specifically about the book on the program following this break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams, and we are beginning today a periodic series on peace building, much needed in today's world. We're talking with Patrick Mason and David Pulsifer, authors of Proclaim Peace, The Restoration's Answer to an Age of Conflict. Patrick Mason is Leonard J. Arrington Chair of Mormon History and Culture and an Associate Professor of Religious Studies and History at Utah State University. He's on the faculty and advisory board of the Hiravi Peace Institute at Utah State University. David Pulsifer is a professor of history at Brigham Young University, Idaho, where he teaches courses on citizenship, civil discourse, peace-building, and nonviolence. David Pulsifer, I'll direct the first question to you in this segment. So the book, Proclaim Peace, is directed, I understand, to a Latter-day Saint audience, but also more broadly, right? And the concept of peace, you know, a very Christian, not exclusively Christian concept, right? Jesus Christ, known as the Prince of Peace, commanded us to have peace. If we had contention, we're not his disciples, etc. I want to talk about the title of the book. So this comes from Latter-day Saint scripture, right? Doctrine and Covenants. Therefore, renounce war and proclaim peace. So that's gets us into kind of definitions of peace, right? Absence of war, I guess, is a kind of a negative description of peace. But proclaim peace, that gets us into a more positive. We're building peace. What do you talk about that?
Yeah, actually, you hit right on a distinction that in peace studies we talk about all the time, which is negative peace and positive peace. Negative peace is the absence of what we call direct violence, which means the absence of people, you know, hitting each other or armies going at each other. If armies are not shooting at each other, we can call that negative violence. The violence is that kind of direct violence is not happening. Positive peace, though, is much more than simply not hurting one another. Positive peace is building the kinds of structures and cultures that lead to human connection and human flourishing. And that can happen, again, in a family, or that can happen on a much larger scale in a nation or the world. But positive peace is sometimes referred to more currently as just peace, meaning that it's a just society. The structures and the culture of the society allow for this kind of connection. It does not necessarily, interestingly enough, mean the absence of conflict. In fact, in peace studies, we don't talk about conflict resolution anymore very much. We talk about conflict transformation. Conflict is just inevitable. It's going to happen anytime you have differences of opinion. People, which is, you know, anybody who's had a friendship or a marriage or worked at any for very long or just lived in the world for very long knows that you can't have even the most basic kinds of relationships and friendships without conflict. So we don't talk about resolving conflict, eliminating conflict. We're talking about transforming conflict into something creative, because conflict can be very, very creative, or it can be extraordinarily destructive. And so changing it from bad conflict into good conflict is what we're all about. And positive peace is not the absence of conflict in society. It means creating a society in which that conflict is harnessed in creative, productive, and even beautiful ways, instead of the destructive forms that we see. And so that to proclaim peace means to, and to renounce war, as I think is renouncing war is to renounce the destructive forms of conflict that we have in our personal lives and in our society. And to proclaim peace is to transform that conflict into something extraordinarily beautiful.
Patrick, I want to have you talk about Enoch, figure of Enoch, and that he's in the Bible, but only briefly. He's much more fully described in the Latter-day Saint scripture. And his assignment was to build Zion, and that's a big, it's in the Bible, but it's much more fully explored in Latter-day Saint scripture. I wonder if you talk a little bit about Enoch and building Zion.
Yeah, this is an important passage of scripture for us. You mentioned the title of the book comes from the revelation that came to Joseph Smith. But he had also early in his career as a prophet and as the leader of the Latter-day Saints, Joseph Smith embarked on a project of trying to translate the Bible, a fairly audacious project, a kind of inspired or revealed translation of the Bible. And part of what he did is he expanded certain parts in the Bible, as you mentioned, that maybe there were mentions or brief stories. And so sometimes Joseph Smith would provide these huge expansions of the text. And one of these is around this kind of mysterious figure of Enoch that appears in the book of Genesis in the Bible. And in Joseph Smith's reworking of the story, which Latter-day Saints consider to be inspired, Enoch is this kind of hesitant prophet. He says he's not a great speaker. He's not a particularly charismatic figure, but he also, so he's called to be a prophet. He's kind of shy about it, but he goes about his duty, and he lives in a time of tremendous conflict, of bloodshed and warfare. And that's one of the things that brings him up short. He's like, what difference can I make? Right. I mean, I'm not even confident in my speaking ability, but as he goes about it, I mean, one of the interesting things about it is it talks about, I mean, the time scales in the Bible are all different than modern time. It talks that over hundreds of years, Enoch labors and he builds a community, and this community comes together and they are committed to the principles of justice, exactly what David was just talking about, that they built a community in which that was characterized by love for one another, that was characterized by just economic relationships. It says there were no poor among them. And because of this, because of the quality of the community they had built, that they were called Zion, which is in biblical terms, the pure in heart or this godly community. And it is protected from their enemies. That it has a kind of divine protection. But it really is, it becomes the model not only for biblical societies, that the concept of Zion recurs throughout the Hebrew Bible, but it really becomes the framework for Latter-day Saints. This becomes a hugely important concept for Joseph Smith. It's something the Latter-day Saints still talk about today, of building Zion. And I think, what we wanted to do to point people back to the Enoch text, to some of these other scriptural texts, is to say that the peace is integral to this. It's not sometimes I think Latter-day Saints can have a rather small view of what Zion is, basically just going to church and kind of fulfilling your religious duties. That's all fine and good. But in this original notion of Zion, it's much more expansive. It is about building societies, communities, in which there is peace, there is love, there is justice. For one another, there's inclusion of various types of people, not just members of the church. So it's a really expansive vision that we found quite captivating. I think it was one of the things that really captured our imagination as we were writing this book, was this Zion building project that I think Latter-day Saints are still called to in the 21st century.
David Pultzber, I want to have you take this concept beyond Latter-day Saints. How do these concepts manifest, or how should they manifest more broadly to entire communities?
Well, I think these concepts are not unique to Latter-day Saints in that sense. I mean, you hear lots of people talking about creating societies that are more just, that have that sense of love and connection and inclusion. Martin Luther King called it the beloved community, right? This idea that we can live, kind of probably most famously expressed in his I Have a Dream speech, where, people can stand together, they can live and respect one another, see one another. It is ultimately creating that space where everyone sees one another as legitimate human beings, even with the differences, right? It's not about eliminating differences. It's about creating this space that allows for those differences to enrich our societies rather than to tear us apart. And so, people from Martin Luther King on and onward and before him have been talking about how do we create that kind of a society. In many ways, the United States itself has been an experiment in, especially, you know, since the Civil War, we were an experiment in how to create a diverse democracy, a place where we can respect and love and help and create conditions that allow people to flourish and thrive both in within their specific kind of unique cultural communities, but then also in this larger national project. And in some ways, you know, the dream of the United States that in our best selves expresses that, you know, e pluribus unum, out of many one. It's kind of this remarkable vision of what a community might look like. It's not just a certain ethnic group. It's not just a certain type of one religion or one political view. It's about about creating space that allows those differences to enrich and flourish. So I think it goes well beyond what Latter-day Saints are trying to create. What Latter-day Saints and the concept of Zion is meant to do is ultimately to kind of, I think, fit in with that kind of bigger vision that many others have seen as well. And that together, we might bring a particular slant to the way we see that society coming together. But there are lots of people who have dreamed and worked and are working today to try to build that kind of place.
Yeah, and I should rush to say that David and I, in writing this book, even though it was primarily a work of Latter-day Saint theology, we have been deeply influenced by people of a variety of religious faiths. I mean, David has mentioned Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement, but we've been influenced by Buddhist thinkers and Muslim thinkers and Jewish and Catholic and secular and Hindu. Obviously, Gandhi, you know, is one of the patron saints of all of this. And so this is not just a Latter-day Saint project. If anything, David and I felt like that maybe Latter-day Saints have been a little bit late to the project. And so we have a lot of things to learn from our sisters and brothers in other religious traditions, other political traditions, other philosophical traditions. And then maybe we can, you know, shine a light on these things from our own distinctive religious texts.
Patrick, I want to direct this question to you first, and we'll get to David's perspective on this. It's kind of a dilemma, and we see this playing out, especially in a big election year. Well-meaning people on both sides who want some of these ideals. We want a just society. We want whatever it is, whatever the ideal is. But we feel like to get there, we have to have power first, right? And since the other side is using scorched earth, techniques, we have to do the same. We have to hate our brother and hate our enemy first, and then we can love them once we get power. I wonder if you talk about that.
Yeah, right. Well, this is one of the great temptations that we have as human beings. And we see this throughout world history, that people who have been on bottom or feel like that they've been oppressed, that once they have an opportunity, they sometimes just turn the tables and then now use the exact same techniques towards their opponents, or feel like that the only techniques they can use to protect themselves in self-defense, to speak up for the oppressed, are the very techniques that their opponents use. There's a kind of mirroring that oftentimes happens in conflict. And peace building suggests that there's a different way, that there's a better way. I actually think this is, you know, David talked about the American experiment. I think the U.S. Constitution, with the great exception of its provisions for slavery, But the basic framework, the political framework that it gives us, is exactly the roadmap that we have to follow. And in fact, our friend Judge Thomas Griffith, the former federal judge who's spoken a lot about this, he talks a lot about the Constitutional Convention and what those founders brought to that, those men in that room in Philadelphia in 1787, that they had to come in with the spirit of compromise in order to achieve the greater good of an American republic that could include all of this difference. And so as Judge Griffith talks about, and I think he's exactly right, that if you want to defend the Constitution, if you say that you believe in the Constitution, if you want to protect America, if you want to protect what makes it great, then you have to enter into it with a spirit of compromise. You have to enter into your political conversations with the same kind of spirit of friendship. They called it the spirit of amity in 1787, but a spirit of friendship and generosity, and even a willingness to give something. Maybe not give everything, compromise isn't being rolled over. But the very basic framework that we have as Americans requires us to listen to each other, to talk to one another, to recognize the good in one another. So actually, when you bring those scorched earth, techniques, and there's plenty of guilt to go around on all sides of the political aisle. This is not unique to any one party. When you're doing that, you're actually betraying the very spirit that brought about the American Republic. So I think we need to get back to that. We need to get back to a kind of spirit of friendship and generosity and even compromise.
David Pulsipher, I would be interested to get your perspective on this intersection of an interaction of power and peace building.
Well, I think it's as Patrick said, it's exactly right. This is the great temptation. There is and it's built into our entire culture in terms of our popular culture, our movies, our video games, which is really the only way to defeat something that's violent is to use violence against it, right? So the idea is if you've got an oppressive dictator, the only way to overcome the oppressive dictator is to rise up and take up arms and throw off the shackles of the dictator, because that the dictator's using violence to maintain their power. Therefore, the only way to overthrow them is to use violence against them. The fascinating thing about some very, very smart studies that have been done is that it's not true. That in fact, the most effective way to fight violence statistically is with nonviolence. And the very most effective forms of nonviolence are nonviolence that's also coupled with a spirit of love. But just even tactical nonviolence that may not have that deep love that Martin Luther King and Gandhi and others just kept insisting on in their efforts is twice as likely statistically to achieve its goals than violence. And that shocks people to learn that nonviolent efforts are twice as effective as violent efforts in achieving their goals. Because it doesn't seem like that's what we learn. And, our movies and our video games teach us otherwise, that the only way to get to the end of the game and to beat the boss is to use a lot of violence against them. And that's just very good studies have shown it's just not true. So changing the mindset, helping people to realize that the most effective tool they have is actually being able to see their opponent as a person, and to be able to engage them in that way, and to be able to not fight fire with fire, but to fight fire with something much more effective, like water. So trying to fight the fight or achieve the power in the same way that we feel is being abused is actually counterproductive.
Well, let's head toward another break. We'll come back with a brief final segment. Just before we go to break, I just wanted to highlight our discussion was making me think of, among many things, an article I recently read in the Atlantic titled How Chile Won Back Its Democracy by Ruth Benchiat. She's highlighting the nonviolence of this movement that ousted Pinochet, but also their mantra of hope. I said, we're going forward with hope, you know, hope against guns, right? And that they happen to win in this case. Let's go to break. We'll have more with Patrick Mason and David Pulsifer. The book is Proclaim Peace, The Restoration's Answer to an Age of Conflict. Thanks for listening to Access U Time. Tom Williams. We are beginning today a periodic series on peace building. We start with the authors of Proclaim Peace, The Restoration's Answer to an Age of Conflict. Well worth the read. That's out and available. We're talking with Patrick Mason and David Pulsifer. So David Pulsifer, the authors. So gentlemen, we just have about 6 minutes left in the conversation. So I want to be open ended here. I'll start with Patrick Mason. What would you like to say, just open-ended here at the end of this conversation?
Yeah, well, I think it's really important to have these conversations. We've talked a lot about hope during this hour, and there is a kind of hopelessness that can come into our politics or into our relationships. And so I just want to inject hopefully into our communities and into for our listeners. That there are tools, there are resources, there are things that they can turn to find some of these tools. It's one of the things that both David and I try to do as educators. We're committed to building a new generation of peace builders. It's not enough just to believe in peace. It's not enough just to wish for peace. You have to make it. You have to create it. You have to be active in doing it. So we can, you know, there are a lot of, online courses. There are a lot of books that you can read. One of our friends and a new faculty member at Utah State University, his name is Chad Ford. He has an amazing book called Dangerous Love that I would highly recommend to anybody. If you want just kind of a one book introduction to some of this, I'd also point our listeners to an amazing organization called Mormon Women for Ethical Government. And while it is, you know, made up of Latter-day Saint women, if you go to their website, they all of their advocacy and activism is based on principles of peacemaking. And they have incredible resources on their website. Again, Mormon Women for Ethical Government, MWEG. And you can go and find lots of tools, lots of resources, and actually some kind of modules to lead you through begin to learn and practice some of these principles of peacemaking. So it doesn't have to be so foreign. It doesn't have to be so ethereal or seem so difficult. It's a very practical set of tools that the people can do to bring more peace into their own lives.
There's about a minute left. I'll give you, David Pulsifer, for the last word. What would you say here at the end of the conversation?
I would just echo what Patrick has already said. I would also highlight another group, Braver Angels, that is doing some great work trying to divide what they call the reds and trying to bring together the reds and the blues and providing a very kind of structured way of having conversations that are challenging. But I also would just end with that note of hope. When I get discouraged, I just go to my classes and I talk to my students and I think this next generation is remarkable, and they are going to do some amazing things, and it gives me hope. My hope is really in the students that I teach. They are doing remarkable work, and they will continue to do that remarkable work. And there are people all over. Just need to look for them. They're there. You can find like-minded people, and you can find training. You can find all sorts of ways and resources that can help.
Well, it's wonderful. Thank you for that. I just want to mention one other. Many you could mention the Front Porch Movement. I really admire them. Voice and civic engagement. Kind of the idea is to get back on the front porch like we used to do and have some conversations across divides. We've been talking with David Pulsifer, who's a professor of history at Brigham Young University, Idaho. He teaches courses on citizenship, civil discourse, peace building, and nonviolence. David Pulsifer, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Patrick Mason is Leonard G. Arrington Chair of Mormon History and Culture and an Associate Professor of Religious Studies and History at Utah State University. He's on the Faculty Advisory Board of the Hirabi Peace Institute at Utah State University. Patrick Mason, thank you so much.
And my pleasure. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you. And again, plug the book, well worth the read, Proclaim Peace, The Restoration's Answer to an Age of Conflict. Thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah today.